From deep inside your radio.
Man, imagine how grateful everybody in the news and opinionating businesses must have been Friday mid-morning Eastern time when they learned that they were going to have to put their 4th of July weekend plans on hold and skedaddle back to some little broom closet studio in Washington to get their FaceTime about the meaning of Sandra Day O'Connor's resignation. No such problem for me as the simulated chime of St. Louis Cathedral in the French Quarter indicated at the top of the broadcast. I'm in New Orleans, Louisiana. This program is being put to bed at the beginning of the giant 4th of July weekend. And on that occasion, it's apropos for us to take note that a decision by the Supreme Court that Sandra Day O'Connor is now vacating has been the subject of several attempts by the Congress to overturn it. Not the eminent domain decision that would allow your local city council to take your land for a Best Buy. Oh, no. That's still in the works. This is one that's been passed by the House of Representatives for years, multiple times, and is believed now, with increased Republican majority in the Senate, to have a good chance of passing the so-called upper house this year as well. That is, of course, the constitutional amendment to prohibit flag burning. That's a long way to go, of course. Three-quarters of the states must ratify it. And it just seems there's an easier way to accomplish this goal on this momentous weekend.
Now I was raised a decent way to swell my heart with pride. Each and every time I saw glory passing by. Raised to think that America was a place you loved to love. And the stars stood for heaven. Stripes stood for faith, and that old flag is what God meant man to fly. But somewhere from a spaceship maybe comes another breed. Oh, these folks are so nutty that it's crazy blue they bleed. And then burn the beloved symbol of our nation's liberty. But the stars still stand for heaven, the stripes still stand for faith, and the killing's what these people really need. So let the flag burners fry on the 4th of July. We'll declare them independent of their skins. We'll bake us up some taters, roast some desecrators, let them fry on the 4th of July. Patriots came, it's red. And the fight came from the only race that's voted since the start. So the stars stand for heaven, the stripes stand for faith. You put those dreams of burning it to bed. Now some people talk of freedom, but let me tell you, friends, your freedom doesn't start until the time when my nose ends. People gave their lives so I could sing this little song. And the stars stand for heaven, stripes stand for faith, and the flag that's burned to ashes never mends. So let the flag burners fry on the 4th of July. Make them part of the fireworks display. We'll shoot off Roman candles and electrocute the vandals. The flag burners fry on the 4th of July. Yeah, Miss Betsy Ross would have wanted it this way. If they don't like it here, they can leave it all behind. Let
from the French Quarter of New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of this very special edition of Le Show. You'll be meeting another special New Orleans musician and hearing his performance moments from now. But first, a copyrighted feature of the broadcast, Tales of Airport Security. Apropos of a holiday weekend, a tale from the previous one. Dear Harry, I traveled back east to Providence, Rhode Island. Oh, Lord. For the Memorial Day weekend, I flew from Chicago's O'Hare Airport to Providence's T.F. Green Airport. I carried only a backpack and a standard-sized duffel bag, both of which I carried on board with me. When I went through the X-ray machines at O'Hare, they pulled my duffel bag aside and asked to search it. I agreed. The security employee first searched a small side pocket that's only big enough for small objects like sunglasses, a cell phone, and the like. He found nothing suspicious in there, so he began searching in the bag itself. It was a tightly packed bag, and he had trouble digging through it. This activity was taking longer than a minute or two, and his facial expressions conveyed a mix of disappointment and frustration. I asked if I could help identify what he thought he was looking for. He stated he was looking for a small tool with, perhaps, a metal blade. He eventually pulled out my toiletry bag and went through it. He finally found a small cuticle tool, only about 2 inches long, with an even smaller edge, and said I couldn't carry it on board. I said that was fine, left it with him, and I proceeded to board the flight and enjoy my weekend. When I flew back on Monday, I glided right through security at TF Green. When I got home, I emptied my bag completely, and that's when I found a small, super tool-like object in the side pocket. Thin and black, about the size of a credit card and only slightly thicker. At first glance, it appears innocuous, but the black plastic is a sheath that covers the tool itself. Inside is a multi-purposed piece of stainless steel that has been cut into it, a bottle opener, a can opener, screwdriver tip, small hex wrench, and more importantly, an inch-long beveled and very sharp blade. The tool is a tchotchke I picked up at a trade show vendor's table a couple of years ago. I didn't even know I still had it. The agent at O'Hare knew he was looking for something potentially hazardous, but couldn't locate it. Though maybe not happy that the cuticle tool is what he found, he was satisfied enough to allow me to continue through the terminal and onto my flight. Now, knowing what he should have found, I'm a bit surprised by the conclusion of his search. But the even bigger surprise is that I skated right through security at TF Green Airport 3 days later, without so much as a raised eyebrow cast towards my duffel bag. I don't know if I feel lucky because I avoided being detained and possibly charged with a crime, or because nobody more sinister boarded my flight with something equally dangerous. Both, perhaps. Bruce, from Oak Park, Illinois. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. We're in New Orleans, Louisiana, and some of the characteristic sounds that I really look forward to when I come to this city are, I think it's a major sixth train whistle. Then there's the off-key tootling of the calliope on the riverboat. And then every Thursday night, like that, and then every Thursday night out of to call it nondescript would be to insult its funkiness, club called Donna's on Rampart Street, comes the most amazing sound of music. And it sounds something like this. So that's Tom McDermott, who's a familiar voice and a pair of hands on this broadcast by now. Tom, say hello so people recognize your voice.
Hello, Harry.
As well as your style. And Evan Christopher on clarinet. Evan?
Hi, Harry.
Hey. Now, you guys must be used by now, because you do this every Thursdays at Donna's. You must be used to the startled faces of tourists coming in expecting to hear Saints and just being sucked into this whole deep, different world of music.
Well, more often they're surprised when it's not a brass band, because that club began its reputation as a sort of a headquarters for the brass bands.
Mm.
And then there are some people who come, and they know our background as being a little more rooted in traditions and the traditional music of New Orleans. So yeah, then every now and then they're surprised, not by the fact that we don't play the Saints, but our forays into other influences and other types of music. So
of the continents, for that
right,
matter.
Right, yeah, for sure.
What was that you just played?
That was the Temptation Rag.
Yes, by Henry Lodge.
1909.
Pan-era rag. Yeah. Not classic rag like Joplin, but more.
No, and probably played, well, I mean, in retrospect, probably played a little too fast.
Hey, got my blood flowing. So how did you guys get together and start doing this?
Well, I was in New Orleans in the mid-90s for a couple years. And right in the first few weeks that I was here, I was subbing for a clarinet player in the new version of the Dukes of Dixieland, and Tom had been doing that for a few years. My introduction to New Orleans was actually on a tour with a band from California, where I'm from originally, and I decided I wanted to stay down there. And the job at the time with the Dukes was it six nights a week or five nights a week? How when you were there on the evening cruises?
Whenever they had enough people to float the boat, so it's sometimes seven.
It was on the evening cruises on the steamboat Natchez, which is the actual one. The only steam powered riverboat that's operating down here right now. And I don't know. We'd end up on things together outside of that.
You were an original member of the Nightcrawlers.
When you started the Nightcrawlers brass band.
And various recording projects that I've tried to put together.
Evan, you're from Long Beach?
Uh-huh. Originally,
funky Long Beach.
Well, you know, everybody's got to be from somewhere. Grew up in Southern California. Yeah, near Long Beach. And I was in Los Angeles proper for a little while, and San Diego, and... Yeah, finished school in Long Beach, and then started touring with a singer songwriter, and ended up in New Orleans in the mid '90s for a little bit, and then took a job outside of New Orleans for I guess about almost 3 years in San Antonio, Texas. Had some nonsense that got me up to upstate New York for a minute, thinking that was close enough to the city. And ended up commuting back and forth from there to New Orleans. Came back 4 years ago, more permanently, which I guess would have been about the time that we met, because we've been doing this Donna's gig for 3 years. Yeah, or maybe we met at Snug Harbor at one of those shows, because we would do that two, three times a year, Tom, huh? Different things.
Oh, sure.
But you started the Donna show after they moved the stage so that people don't have to go up on the bandstand to get to the bathroom, right?
Yeah, that's when it was the brass band headquarters. And that was when it was really hard to navigate that space, when they had the...
walk past a tuba player, which some people never do their whole life.
Or between, you know, right. Or, you know, between two drummers.
Yeah, I mean, you know. Exactly. Excuse me, I have to get through here. I know you're playing a gig, but...
Yeah, that was funny how they had that. Oh. That was great.
It was. I don't know who was more of a challenge for, the patron or the player, but... I bring people down. I insisted friends come to that gig, and
we'd love you for that.
Thank you. More often than not, they'll come back and say, you know, I got to go back to that because that's my favorite thing in New Orleans.
Being on the edge of the French Quarter really helps the vibe, because it ends up not feeling like Bourbon Street. It ends up, I mean, if you've walked from Bourbon Street to get there, I mean, you definitely feel like, I mean, you're going through a residential neighborhood, and all of a sudden, I think you have the impression of it being, oh, this is, I'm going to experience something more real, you know, once you get away from the Disney kind of thing of Bourbon Street. And it also makes a nice balance of the clientele. You get a balance of locals and tourists. And for Tom and me, we have a reputation, you know, outside of New Orleans, and so we also get a fair amount of people who actually are just coming to look for us specifically. Mm. And it's a real New Orleans experience.
And aside from us, I mean, the rest of the week has a great lineup as well. So you can pretty much tell somebody just whenever they're open, go there.
Evan, did you play clarinet in high school? Is that how you start on the instrument?
I guess I started in junior high school, actually. I started when I was about 11 years old.
And what drew you to the instrument?
Aesthetically, I think it's a pretty neat-looking instrument. I played some piano before that, and I'm guessing what drew me to it was more the fact that I was small for my age and young for my grade, and there, you know, brass instruments weren't really an option. And then when I heard the first jazz records with clarinet on them, I was sold.
Who were you listening to? Artie Shaw?
Artie Shaw was my first influence, followed by Johnny Dodds, the New Orleans clarinetist with the early bands of King Oliver and Louis Armstrong. And then there are a lot of players that I discovered over time, and you know, with each one, it just seemed like confirmation that yeah, this was the instrument of jazz. Until you get to high school, and then they have a big band instrumentation, and yeah, I had to switch to saxophone for a few years, and I guess at some point when I was in university, I realized how many saxophone players there were out there. Not even a dime a dozen, but like a nickel mm-hmm, a dozen mm-hmm. or something. I mean, just way too many of them. And the clarinet being my first instrument, saxophone was always easy coming from clarinet. Mm. But I noticed that saxophone players, for whatever reason, have a real hard time going to clarinet. So just the pragmatism of wanting to be a working musician, I went back to the clarinet because it was just less competition.
Is that more about lips or more about fingering?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Hmm. I haven't really asked anybody why they think that is, but consistently, you know, you get saxophone players basically saying, better you than me.
Did you ever get to meet Artie Shaw?
I did not. By the time I even realized that he was living a few miles from me, he had a reputation for being pretty curmudgeon-y.
That started pretty early for him,
and,
too.
And I never got the impression that he would really give a damn about... If I wanted to talk to him, he might want to talk about writing or literature or classical music or anything, but you know, wanting to hear that he was... you know, somewhat responsible for me going down a path that he went on record many times saying was probably, you know, the source of as much misery as success for him. I just never thought he'd really be interested. I never wanted to bother him with it.
On the other hand, you've been lucky so far because, as I understand it, Artie Shaw's a lot of his distress. I mean, it's hard to be a band leader. It's hard to be a leader, as anybody who's heard the Buddy Rich tapes can attest. but he was in the music business. He was in the serious, you know, big label.
Oh, for sure. We have a distinct advantage that the music we play will never be popular. or never be popular again, shall we say.
Well, it'll never be popular enough to be bothered by those guys. I mean, you know, not to say that any music is popular enough to be involved with the record business these days, because if you listen to them, they're dying. But
That's true.
He was like the first guy to really blow the whistle on how miserable a lot of the workings of the record business were.
Yeah, sure. From Stephen Foster and James Bland in the 19th century all the way up through, you know, through any of the contemporary artists today that would love to feel like they're able to do something more meaningful. You have people complaining about the nature of what makes popular music popular.
Yeah. And what happens after it gets popular, too.
Right, sure, yeah.
Where the money goes. But enough about money. Like, let's hear another tune by you guys.
Yeah, sure. We've got a bunch of Daryl Morton stuff in the repertoire. We should definitely do something by Jelly. So we want to do that sweet substitute.
Sounds good.
Okay. ¶¶
more with our guests, Evan Christopher and Tom McDermott, moments from now. But first,
Los Angeles dog trainer corrections for you.
It's a good bunch this week. An article in Wednesday's California section on last week's hot spell said sunrise in Los Angeles was at 5:13 a.m. June 21st. Sunrise was at 5:42 a.m. Sunset was at 8:08 p.m., 14 hours and 26 minutes later, not 14 hours and 55 minutes later, as reported in the Dog Trainer. An article in Sunday's sports section about the U.S. Track and Field Championships said Lashinda Demus, who won the women's 400-meter hurdles, was a former standout at Long Beach's Poly High. She attended Wilson High in Long Beach. An obituary of Carolyn Leonetti Amundsen that appeared in Thursday's California section said she was 83 when she died. She was 87. A Newswire item in Saturday's sports section said former USC football and basketball player Tom McGarvin was 80 when he died. He was 88. A map in Saturday's California section with an article about tourism in Lee Vining, California, said the Tioga Pass is west of Tuolumne Meadows on California 120. The pass is at the eastern entrance to Yosemite National Park, about 8 miles east of Tuolumne Meadows. East-west, 80-88. A report in the June 22 calendar section said that Larry Kierkegaard was responsible for the acoustical improvements made 8 years ago to the Kennedy Center Concert Hall in Washington. Those improvements were made by Christopher Jaffe. In the Tours and Cruises column of the travel section, June 26th, an item on a restoration tourism project trip to Nepal said the journey begins December 20th. The departure date is actually October 24th. Hope that didn't inconvenience you any. A Los Angeles Times Magazine article Sunday about the increasing number of elderly prisoners in California prisons incorrectly stated that former Governor Gray Davis said that murderers would leave prison during his term only, quote, in a pine box. Davis did not actually make this remark. An article on NASA's Deep Impact mission in the June 23rd calendar weekend contained incorrect information about the spacecraft's impactor, which will collide with a comet on Sunday night. The impactor does not carry explosives, but instead will release the kinetic energy estimated to be the equivalent of 4.5 tons of TNT. In addition, the spacecraft was launched January 12th of this year, not, as we reported, in 1999. An article in Thursday's home section on architectural follies included a photo caption that said the Royal Pavilion was in Brighton, Wales. Brighton is in England. Los Angeles Dog Trainer Corrections, ladies and gentlemen, and you know who they are for. Now more with Tom and Evan. I didn't start hearing you guys as a big trad fan, so maybe my surprise is misplaced, but I'm always amazed by how expressive your approach to the music is. You know, it never seems curatorial. You know, it seems like the hot stuff is really hot. The sweet and sensitive stuff is really gets there. You know, it just the emotional range of the music surprises me.
Thanks. I guess there are a couple of. I mean, for one thing, there are certain things that are not really very traditional about what we do. That helps. That helps. At no point do we ever think about it being like a repertory kind of thing. In fact, maybe that's one of the biggest differences between us is I do have more experience with the repertory kind of idea, and I love the project because we get to depart from it, you know, sometimes really, you know, big departures, and I always feel a little self-conscious because people aren't coming with a point of reference for some of the musics we're playing. I always think I need to kind of encourage Tom to kind of to be a little more traditional just at first, just to build a frame of reference.
Learn the melody.
Well, you know what I mean. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've been playing these things forever, so in a way, it's sort of. Our sense of continuity is performance by performance, and we have to remind ourselves to go back to a point where the continuity starts from the, you know, the composition or the intentions of the composer in the piece's inception. Mm-hmm. And that's hard for us to remember sometimes.
Back to letter A.
I mean, Tom, I mean, I know that's probably the thing that you and I
yeah.
have the most.
Well, you know, I was talking to somebody last night. We play with this magnificent drummer, Shannon Powell, who can go from the softest, you know, imaginable brush work to, you know, hell's on fire.
His brushwork is really soft here today.
Extremely. Hi, Shannon. How you doing? And I was telling somebody that the same energy in this music is, you know, maybe I think of the revival guys too. It's a little bit like, you know, rockabilly or something. There's something that's very raw that I love to bring to it that you rarely hear. I mean, you go and hear a lot of New Orleans jazz and it's just like
careful.
So it's dull.
It's careful.
Yeah. It's, you know, well, don't play wrong notes. Don't.
My complaints about what most people do with the traditional music are maybe a little bit different. But, yeah, dull in terms of, you know, I like to tease. I mean, we're not, you know, we'll tease about songs that we do that and tease that, oh, I know you've been up and down Bourbon Street hearing every band play this. And, you know, it'll be something not really obscure, in my opinion, but just by just out of sheer repetition, what has become the standard canon for the traditional jazz is just pathetically narrow.
in terms of the repertoire.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
And so,
but also in terms of the style. I mean, it's just this music at some point was really hot.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
It really could inflame a crowd. And that's what I see when you guys are up there is that whether it's the Brazilian stuff you do or the New Orleans stuff you do, it regains that power.
Cool. Well, then we're doing something right,
yeah.
And that's good. The rhythmic continuity and the rhythmic similarities, the familial resemblance of the different musics that we're exploring is sort of one of the ways that we tie everything together a little bit to be able to do the music of the French West Indies and the music of early Brazilian music, ragtime, you know, more contemporary New Orleans music, R&B, and you know, getting Tom all the way from Louis Merle Gottschalk to James Booker and beyond. I mean, it's the rhythmic continuity that makes that possible and makes I hope that's what makes it seem kind of integrated and maybe purposeful,
especially to a generation that thinks rock and roll invented rhythm, you know, as a driving force in popular music, you know.
And that's the beauty of having someone like Shannon Powell, for sure.
When I first started hearing you guys play together, I think I saw an in-store at Louisiana Music Factory when you were working on the Donza project. And Tom said something, and I don't know what I don't know about the clarinet could fill a phone book, but he said you had a different approach to playing the instrument, and that accounted for a difference in the way it sounded. Am I recalling that correctly?
Yeah, the Albert system.
Well, I use an outdated the horns I have have an outdated fingering system, meaning that they're simpler versions of the instrument as the Germans play it now. The instruments themselves are French models of that of that system, but yeah, it's a little bit different. It takes you in some directions. For me, because all the early New Orleans, or most of the early New Orleans players played the Albert system, and I can tell that from the pictures. Maybe not even as much from the sound, because it turns out that you can really get pretty close as long as you're, you know, whatever sound you're thinking about is what sound's going to come out of your horn. But I definitely felt like to switch to that system kept me closer. It kept me closer to those colors and those sounds of the early New Orleans clarinet players, and I don't know. So it's the concept of the earlier sound that I'm trying for, as well as the fingering system of the instrument and its its limitations that combined are how I'm trying to stay grounded in the New Orleans clarinet tradition.
Again, because I know nothing about the instrument, this was a simplified fingering system, is what you're talking about?
Well, it was just, it predated the system that most players use, which is called BEM. Not by a lot, only only by a couple decades.
Called Boom? B-O-E-H-M?
B-O-umlaut.
Oh.
H-M. Or B-O-E-H-M, I guess, because we don't have the umlaut. And this one they
even
called the...
Except in heavy metal.
Right. They got that from a Löwenbräu bottle. Is that the story? Sitting around.
Is that right?
Yeah. Motley Crue, they're just sitting around somewhere. They said, yeah, the umlaut's cool.
So the Boom system.
Yeah, anyway, but I saw all the old pictures of the New Orleans guys. I saw pictures of Jimmy Noone and Johnny Dodds and Omer Simeon and Irving Fazola.
Homer Simpson?
No, Omer. Omer Simeon.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They kind of had similar profiles, actually. And I don't know, you know, all those pictures in black and white, so I don't know what the...
And you said last night on the bandstand you heard somebody refer to Jimmy Noone as Jimmy No One.
Someone told me that story, that someone on the radio announced him as Jimmy No One. Yeah. But I love the horn I'm playing now. It's an old French Selmer. I like it because of the way it looks in pictures. In fact, on the Donza record, there's been a lot of confusion because I used a different clarinet for the pictures than I actually played on the album, just because I thought it was more photogenic. But I mean, which was silly because Tom on that album cover, Tom's we got a picture of a crappy upright piano that you would never have recorded a record on, but nobody got confused about that. It really made some. You know, yeah, the other thing, you get some people in this that are attracted to these traditions, and they can be pretty pedantic. I think some of our strongest critics, in the negative sense, are ones that like you say, are actually expecting a more of a repertory experience, and I don't know what they would get out of that. But definitely, a contemporary audience is far less interested in. They don't have a point of reference for the music, and they're more interested in the things that we're trying to explore, which are the varying degrees of intensity and the emotional shadings that you can get from exploring that rhythmic and melodic language.
Evan and I have heard traditional jazz in many settings around the world, and it really is special to hear it in New Orleans, to see people dancing to it. I mean, it's always alarming when we play this music in a tourist environment. Nobody's moving, twitching, completely still. And New Orleans is not, if you go to Donna's, you're going to see people boogieing and, you know, second lining. Not always, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you do another tune?
Yeah, sure. You want to do a couple of the Brazilian things?
Yeah. Carinhoso.
This is probably one of the most beautiful Brazilian compositions we know, by the flautist Pixinguinha.
What did he flout? Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Evan Christopher and Tom McDermott, our special guests on this very special 4th of July weekend edition of Le Show. We'll give Evan a chance to, whatever they do with their reed, do they wet them or dry them? I don't know. And Tom will just sit there attentively while we present another copyrighted feature of this broadcast, The Apologies of the Week.
We're so sorry.
There's a theme to a couple of these apologies, ladies and gentlemen. See if you can tell what it is. Dateline Washington. The U.S.-Asia foreign policy establishment is positively gaga over a transmission error by consultant Chris Nelson, author of the highly authoritative Nelson Report, a must-read for those involved in foreign affairs, especially Asia. Nelson prepared an exceptionally frank special report for the Embassy of the Republic of South Korea, entitled Players on Korea Policy in Washington. Acknowledging his brutal assessments, he warned the embassy that if any capital, any of this report is seen by any capitals, anyone outside of the embassy, its humble author is going to have to receive political asylum, unquote. Instead of sending the 22-page analysis to the Korean embassy, unfortunately, Nelson hit the mailing list for subscribers to the Nelson Report. Administration officials, officials on Capitol Hill, think tankers, media types, and others. More than 800 people, including many of whom he had skewered or identified as people who talked to him. He wrote that the administration's failed policy on North Korea, not to mention its bunker mentality, will not change as long as Dick Cheney is vice president, Steve Hadley is national security advisor, and even apparently so long as Condi Rice is secretary of state.
Sorry.
On Capitol Hill, Nelson says one House aide is genuinely mentally unbalanced. Seriously, this is not a sarcasm in the view of his staff colleagues. Nelson names the aide. One House member is difficult, another a blowhard. While the possibility that either of the two candidates to succeed the chairman of the International Relations Committee is, quote, a terrifying prospect to serious foreign policy players. Nelson also criticizes some newspaper reporters. New York Times reporter David Sanger is dishonest by omission. Washington Times reporter Bill Gertz is dishonest by commission. In a follow-up email, an anguished Nelson wrote to his email list, quote, in a single moment of stupidity, I have hurt and betrayed many who have tried so generously to help and who share my deepest fears about Korea policy. Apology is impossible at this point. I can only ask mercy. Apology is impossible, ladies and gentlemen. Why does that qualify as an apology? Dateline Poughkeepsie, New York, a New York State lawmaker, says he's embarrassed after he mistakenly sent out an email message that referred to his constituents as idiots. Assemblyman Willis Stevens says he thought he was sending the email to an aide. Instead, he sent the note to nearly 300 people in an online discussion group that focuses on the community of Brewster, New York. The message included the comment that he was, quote, just watching the idiots pontificate. Within an hour, Stevens sent another email apologizing for the slip-up. Watch those emails, will you, ladies and gentlemen? That's good advice from the Apology of the Week department. And an off-color remark by Texas Governor Rick Perry has spurned internet sales of T-shirts, coffee mugs, and even baby bibs. Using a shortened version of a two-word expletive, Perry ended an exchange with a television reporter, quote, adios, mofo. The remark, caught on tape June 20th after he finished an interview, was later aired by the Houston ABC affiliate. T-shirts bearing Perry's face and the phrase, adios, mofo, popped up on the internet within hours. Perry, a Republican who has used a church school gymnasium to sign a bill asking voters to approve a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, has apologized. The comment, he said, was inappropriate banter directed towards his deputy press secretary. And finally, Bright Eyes, that's a pop group, star Connor Oberst has apologized to fans who were offended by comments he made about the late British DJ John Peel and the Make Poverty History campaign, centerpiece of Live 8, while performing at last weekend's Glastonbury Festival in England. Oberst was headlining the event's John Peel stage, named after the legendary disc jockey who died of a heart attack last year, when he made a number of rude remarks that angered his audience. Oberst claims he was so intoxicated during the show he could hardly remember it. In a statement, he now says, I would like to express my sincerest apology to the friends and family of Mr. Peel for anything I said during our performance at Glastonbury. I truly don't remember much of the show, but have been informed since of what I said, and it was way out of line and far from my real feelings. I have nothing but respect for John Peel and his beautiful gift for sharing music. I never had the pleasure of meeting him, but by all accounts he was an outstanding man and deserves much more respect than I showed. I am very sorry. Doesn't indicate that he's going to go on the wagon, however. Ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And totally unintoxicated here are Tom and Evan. Evan, do you have other musical projects in mind as you look forward?
Oh, gosh, Harry. You know, I mean, a ton of things. And they're all very top secret. And,
okay.
No, I just need to be working on being a better clarinetist. I want to be a virtuoso on this instrument. It's what I really want to do.
Do you have any interest in larger ensembles?
I've been doing. I got to do a little writing for sort of some jazz band and chamber orchestra things, and I guess you could say I'm kind of dabbling. It's not something I've taken the time to study as formally as one would have to do to really do that. But I would say there'll be some projects in the not too distant future that'll reflect an orientation more toward the possibilities of arranging and the possibilities imposing these sounds, these particular clarinet sounds, in a different context. As if you were going to say a concerto for New Orleans style clarinet, in a way. I mean, I guess that's what I'd like to find a way to do is to use the language of this instrument as it evolved from these early a lot of the Creole clarinet players, but you know, just a musical language that evolved specific to New Orleans on this instrument that I think could be used in other applications. I mean, almost like you'd say, I'm going to write a concerto for some kind of exotic instrument, you know, but it's, even though it's still a clarinet.
Concerto for Balinese gamelan.
Well, yeah, right, but there's something still, there is an exotic, and I think that's something that people pick up on, too. There is an exoticism to the New Orleans sound that makes almost anything that we do seem like a hybrid of things that they know or think they know, and I think people, at least the history of popular music has shown that's something that's attractive to people.
Mm-hmm. Hybrids are cool.
Hybrids are cool.
Yeah. It's weird about that. People are so much more into the idea of hybridization when it involves music than when it involves people. Sometimes.
Oh, you think?
Sometimes.
Well, I mean, New Orleans, the population of New Orleans would argue against that. Might be an example of where that's not necessarily
the case. I know, but
that's
another reason why the city's special in a sense, you know,
yeah,
as opposed to the rest of the country.
Right.
But people can look forward to seeing you guys at Donna's for a while longer?
I guess so. I mean, you know.
We're off for the summer, pretty much.
Yeah, we're gone for the summer. But this is a project that just seems to kind of keep unfolding now with the Tom's Brazilian project that we just did, and we keep doing these kind of neat presentations, little themed presentations on the music of Gerald Earl Morton, and we've done concert programs where they're starting to actually exploit the connection of ragtime with choro, and I don't know, it's I don't know. It just doesn't seem to want to die. So I guess we'll be there forever.
Well, it's a highlight of my week, and I know of a lot of other people. So I sure hope so.
Well, you bring a lot to the table. We're honored to have you.
Oh, thanks. So let's maybe do one more song.
Yeah. Let's see. We did a rag. We did a piece by Gerald Earl Morton. We did the Brazilian choro. You want to do one of yours?
Yes, why don't we do Casa Denise as a part of town in Rio? ago called Santa Teresa, which is the old 19th century. It's the oldest part of Rio still extant. They've torn down a lot of the city, but this was up in the mountain, a mountain in the middle of the city where they can't build a 30-story skyscraper.
What's unique about this piece is it actually, one of Tom's friends summed it up best. It's really a rag choro. I mean, it shows Tom's personal roots and or our roots really in the traditional American syncopated music, with our attempt to get a handle on the Brazilian syncopated music. So it's this is our hybrid.
My thanks to Tom and Evan for being my very special guests on this very special edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant, WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz, shortwave, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. On Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 108 and available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow. And it would be just like remembering not to hit that send all button on your email unless you're really sure if you'd join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much, huh? Address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the Pittsburgh desk and to Drew at Piety Street, the studio of the stars, for recording today's broadcast. And to Bob Dunn at WWL-TV for his transmissional aid. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Evan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Harry.
That was fun.